I like that 80s. That's sexy. These should get more dramatic. Here it comes. Here it comes. Fanacek, yeah. Steven Bochco is next on Fanacek. Hey folks, all right, it is S3E2 here on Fanacek. Very, very excited. Today we are talking about a gentleman named Mr. Steven Bochco. He did a lot of great TV shows, a lot of stuff that I grew up on, probably a lot of stuff that you watched. Maybe some of you grew up on it as well. I'm excited. We're going to dive in. But first, I thought I would get to some updates. I thought I'd mention an email that I got. So I do get some emails. Not all of them are terribly interesting or show-worthy, if you will. So you guys need to step up your emails. But I got one from Jeannie Betts. Jeannie Betts lives in LA or somewhere around there, but she had corresponded with me asking where I lived when I had lived out in Los Angeles, and she wanted to know what filming locations I'd been to out there. Let me tell you, that warranted some thought. I had to give that one some thought. So I got a list in no particular order, but I'm trying to list all the filming locations, whether it's TV or movies, that I've been to while out in LA. So I'm trying to think of a lot. So first of all, I spent a lot of time on the Warner Brothers lot. And I was actually in a soundstage that originally was used for Casablanca because they had a big plaque out there saying Casablanca had been filmed there. But also at the time, it was being used for Gilmore Girls. And I was filming a short film starring Melissa McCarthy, that she had based on a Growlings character that she did called Marbles. And, you know, at the time, Melissa McCarthy wasn't really famous yet. She was on the show Gilmore Girls. And in the show, which I never saw, the girl goes to an Ivy League school, I guess. So this was the set for the Ivy League school. Melissa McCarthy and her husband, Ben Falcone, were borrowing it to make the short film. And since I was a Growlings student, I went there and did some work on it. But I had an all-access pass to the Warner Brothers lot, which was fucking nuts. So I remember roaming around the lot. I remember seeing the ambulance bay from ER, and across from the ambulance bay there that diner they used to always go to. I saw them filming Two and a Half Men. Obviously, I mentioned Gilmore Girls. While I was living in LA, I drove out to Burbank and specifically went and sought out Kevin Arnold's house from the Wonder Years. That was pretty cool, that street. And it still looks the same. It's pretty neat. You feel like you're back in 1969 with little Kevin Arnold throwing the football around in front of Winnie Cooper. I went and saw the house from 6 feet under, like that mansion. It's pretty wild. I went and saw that. I've been to the lake. It's not Silver Lake. I forget what the hell lake it is in the middle of LA there. But that there's this like dirt trails around it, and that's where they filmed the opening for the Andy Griffith Show. You know, saw that. Saw the Double Indemnity house while I was living out there. I saw a couple of Rebel Without a Cause things. I've been, of course, to the observatory where he gets where that knife fight is and all that. I think it's a knife fight, is it not? Or who the hell remembers? And also the monkey house from that movie where, remember when James Dean's like laying in the street playing with the tin monkey who's like bashing the cymbals? I've been there. Where else have I been? I've been to Neptune's Net, which is on the PCH. A bunch of stuff has been filmed at Neptune's Net. You got to look it up. I know like there's like a famous scene from Fast and the Furious, which I've never seen any of those movies, but they apparently filmed at Neptune's Net. What else? Paradise Cove, which is also on PCH. It's in Malibu. Of course, that's where Rockford lived from the Rockford Files. I've been to Musso and Frank's. I had my first ever martini at Musso and Frank's, and that's obviously made famous recently in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's where they go and have Rick Dalton has drinks with Marvin Schwartz. That's also, though, the parking lot from Musso and Frank's is where they filmed the fight scene from Swingers. So in Swingers, they go to the Dresden, which, by the way, I've been to the Dresden. That's a cool little bar in the Los Feliz area of Los Angeles. And that's where like that older couple, I forget their name, Mickey and something, where they're one plays guitar, one plays drums, or I think it's keyboards and drums, whatever the hell it is. That older couple. Well, that's the Dresden. And then outside of the Dresden, Swingers, that's when they get into that, they start pulling guns on the whole, you know, those guys who bump into them. Well, Dresden doesn't actually have a parking lot. So that scene is actually filmed in the Musso and Frank's parking lot, where Brad Pitt says to Leonardo DiCaprio, "Don't cry in front of the Mexicans." So I've been to all those, and I think that kind of wraps up. I'm sure I've seen other stuff. Oh, I used to walk by the hotel, although I didn't realize at the time. It's a little shitty motel where where Julie Roberts lived in Pretty Woman. At the end, Richard Gere climbs up the fire escape to save her. I've been there, and I think that wraps it up. I don't know, man. That was the best I could do on 4 o'clock in the morning, drinking some coffee, trying to figure out what filming locations I've been to. So, Miss Jenny Betts, thank you. That is that. And also, one thing, a little update. I have been corresponding on Facebook with Eddie Deason, and I'm pretty excited about that. So Eddie Deason played Eugene in Grease. So he and I hit each other up on Facebook and have been chatting. And I kind of initiated it, honestly, to make my wife jealous. She loves Grease. So I started a conversation with him and I showed her, look at me. I'm talking to Eddie Deason. So that's pretty cool. But enough about Fanichek. Let's talk about my man, Stephen Bochco. So what I'll do is I'll give you a quick once over on his life and career. Then we'll kind of intertwine his story as we go through his TV shows. But Stephen Bochco was born December 16th, 1943. He passed away April 1st of 2018 of leukemia. He was born to a Jewish family in New York City. He's the younger brother of actress Joanna Frank. She kind of had a run. She did a little bit as an actress. She was in The Outer Limits, The Fugitive, Ben Casey, Policewoman, L.A. Law, amongst others. L.A. Law will come back for obvious reasons. After college, he began his career as a writer and story editor for Universal Studios. So that's where he started. That's a great place to start. From there, he went to MTM Enterprises and added producing to his list of duties. Does anyone know what MTM stands for? Da-na-na-na-na-na-na. That's Mary Tyler Moore, man. He worked and worked for Mary Tyler Moore Productions, but that didn't last too long. It was short-lived. He was eventually fired. He took his talents to 20th Century Fox, where he had even more success. So what happened was, he goes to 20th Century Fox. ABC gets in a bidding war for Stephen Bochco, because they just ended their relationship with Aaron Spelling. So ABC wins the bidding war, and they signed Bochco to basically a deal to produce and create 10 new TV shows, which warrants him to start Bochco Productions. So now Stephen Bochco is at his own company, a 10-show deal with ABC. Life is looking good. He would eventually leave network TV, which we'll discuss later. He ventured in some internet projects and some cable television. And again, we're going to intertwine all this as we go through his credits. He was married 3 times and eventually passed away at the age of 74. He's a 10-time Primetime Emmy winner and a legend and a shaper of modern drama and storytelling. We'll tell more of his story, like I said, as we go through the credits, which we're going to start doing now, I guess. So let's look at his writing and producing credits, because there are 48 writing credits. There are 35 producing credits, but it all starts with the writing. So let's start there. His first credit is the 1964 TV movie, The Movie Maker. Now, I had to do some sleuthing here. There was some confusion with this credit. You hear conflicting things. So this was also titled, so again, it was called The Movie Maker. It was also titled A Slow Fade to Black. It was featured as part of the Bob Hope Presents the Chrysler Theater. Now, that was an early anthology series, which was very, very common during early TV. So why don't we veer off the road for a second, talk about a little bit of TV history. So anthology shows were very common. As soon as we started doing regular programming, anthology shows were the first thing they did, because it was live TV. They didn't have tape yet, right? They weren't able to record. So what they would do is they would do existing productions, stage productions, books, whatever it was, and they would hire these working actors, and they would just put on these shows every week, every day, whatever it may be. Almost kind of like a soap opera, except not an ongoing story, right? So they would, 1 week they do this play starring these actors, the next week they do this play. So that started to become the thing. So everything was an anthology show. They didn't have scripted ongoing shows yet. Now, you got to remember something. This was called Bob Hope Presents the Chrysler Theater, right? Chrysler Cars. Because at that time, the shows, the networks were controlled by the advertisers. So original TV, the original concept was, we'll find an advertiser or a company, whatever. They would create the show, essentially. So someone would come in like, General Food, General Mills, right? They make Cheerios and shit. General Mills would come in and say, we want to advertise, so let's create a show. And we want to do a show about a female police officer. So then they would go to an advertising agency. The advertising agency would create the show, and then General Mills would run the show. Like, it's, they're in charge of it. And then it became like a bidding war of who wanted to put it on, NBC, CBS, whatever. Very, very backwards. They controlled everything. The network was basically just a distribution channel, if you will. That all changed. Pat Weaver, a guy named Pat Weaver, was at NBC. Amongst other things, he created the Today Show. By the way, do you know one of the original hosts of the Today Show is a chimpanzee? That's a fact. You got to look it up. But the Today Show is kind of conceived as, you know, news and entertainment, kind of for housewives, which I think it still does that, really. But I'm not kidding about the chimpanzee. Look that up. But Pat Weaver was a genius, and he was the first one to think of, no. We're going to control the show. We're going to create a show. We're going to run our own schedule, and we're going to find advertisers who want to buy time on our show. So instead of fucking Chef Boyardee or Ford, for that matter, Chef Boyardee was a weird example. So instead of Ford saying we're going to create a show and we're going to put it on NBC and control everything, NBC is like, no. We're going to create a show, and if you want Ford, you can have a 2-minute commercial during it, and if you want General Mills, you can have a 30-second commercial, and if you want, and they control the show. So it wasn't until NBC and Pat Weaver that networks actually ran their own shows and their own scheduling. It's kind of wild. Anyway, I thought I'd give a little history to TV there for you. As we take it for granted, commercials are so common now. That wasn't the case. Every show had one sponsor, and that sponsor owned the show. All right, back to what I was talking about. So Bob Hope presents a Chrysler Theater. This thing was originally called A Slow Fade to Black. The other writer, along with Stephen Bochco, that's credited to this project is Rod Serling. How cool is that? He was obviously the writer, creator, host of The Twilight Zone. This TV movie featured an amazing cast: Rod Steiger, Dabney Coleman, who we talked about in the 9 to 5 episode, Robert Culp, who is one of my favorites, Bob Culp. Look him up. That guy's a 2-time Columbo killer. Columbo's going to come up later in a big way, by the way. This also features Sally Kellerman. So that is the movie maker. So Stephen Bochco launches his career with a bang. So anyhow, back to Mr. Bochco and his writing career. His next writing credit is the 1968 film The Counterfeit Killer. Okay, The Counterfeit Killer. Great title, great poster, great synopsis, great cast. I'm going to pull it up on my trusty phone here. Let's pull it up. I'm so sorry. Counterfeit Killer, 1968. Is there a link between the murder of 5 foreign sailors from the East whose bodies have been found on the San Pedro waterfront and the issue of $1 million counterfeit dollars in the USA? Don Owens, an undercover agent, assisted by Angie, a beautiful but embittered widow who has fallen for him, does his best to untangle the knot. That's a lot going on there. It is a cool poster. It's got my man Jack Lord on it. Assassin? Or agent. His hot gun works both sides of the fence for a fortune in hot money. A really cool poster. Actually, I might want to buy that one. But it stars Jack Lord. I love Jack Lord. He was, of course, the star for like 12 years of Hawaii Five-0. I've got a really cool check, which I've talked about, framed in my office. 1958, he was paying for his life insurance to New York Life, and I owned the check. Also featured Shirley Knight. I've talked about Shirley Knight before. She had a long career. I always know her as Helen Hunt's mom in As Good As It Gets. Jack Weston was in this. He, of course, was Mr. Kellerman in Dirty Dancing. He was in Cactus Flower. He was in The Thomas Crown Affair, the original one. Who else was in this? Robert Pine. That's Chris Pine's dad. L.Q. Jones. Nicholas Colasanto. He's been coming up a lot lately. Nicholas Colasanto was Coach in Cheers. He passed away, like, I think in season 2 or 3 of Cheers and was replaced by Woody Harrelson. So after this, though, Stephen starts to do his first work in series television, writing 4 episodes of The Name of the Game. The Name of the Game has a cool synopsis. Let me pull this one up. So The Name of the Game, it ran from 1968 to 1971. Here is the synopsis. This groundbreaking series had 3 rotating stars who were featured in independent episodes tied together by a loose common theme: Howard Publications, the publishing empire of Glenn Howard. Episodes featuring Howard focused on his business and political confrontations and his flamboyant lifestyle. Other episodes featured Jeff Dillon, a crusading investigative reporter, and Dan Farrell, a retired FBI agent who used his position as the editor of Crime Magazine to wage a literary war against organized crime. The series had several semi-regulars, including editorial assistant Peggy Maxwell and junior reporters Joe Sample, Andy Hill, and Ross Craig. That's kind of cool. Star Gene Barry. I started a young Susan St. James. God, she was so hot when she was young. She had a hell of a career. She would go on to be in McMillan and Wife, Kate and Allie, all that stuff. Robert Stack was in this. Who else? I think that's about it. Yeah. Oh, and a cool guest stars. I made a list of the guest stars on this show. So guests included Jimmy Mack, Darren McGavin. Darren McGavin was, he was a dad in A Christmas Story, amongst other things. Jack Klugman, Suzanne Plachette, Clu Gulager, and others. So that is The Name of the Game. So now, around this time, Stephen Bochco also starts to write and create his first show. which was The Bold Ones, The New Doctors. There's a little bit of a story here because The Bold Ones kind of was a recurring theme. So let's take a look here. The Bold Ones, The New Doctors, it was a TV series, ran from 1969 to 1973, lasted 45 episodes. The case of well-respected neurosurgeon Dr. David Craig and his two young charges. So I made a note here to take a look at the trivia because I want to help you understand what this show was about or kind of big picture what it was. So the series was one of four rotating elements under the Bold Ones umbrella. However, by the time the series went off the air in 1973, it was the only element of the original four series that was still on the air. I don't recall what the other ones were. I know there was the Bold Ones, the Lawyers, the Bold Ones, the Doctors, or the New Doctors. So basically, the Bold Ones was an umbrella for all these different professional shows. Had a good run. This cast, this one starred David Hartman, E.G. Marshall, Jane Wyman. Jane Wyman's an Oscar winner. She's also the first wife of Mr. Ronald Reagan, so there's that. But that is The Bold Ones, The New Doctors. So around this time now, it's all happening at the same time, so I had to really kind of keep this straight so I can tell a decent story. So around this time, though, Stephen Bochco also starts producing. He produced a 1972 episode of Banachek. That show ripped off my name, man. He wrote and produced a 1972 TV movie, Lieutenant Schuster's Wife, with Lee Grant and Jack Warden. Now he's off to the races, right? So he's writer, he's producer, and wait, forgot to mention something. It's monumental. It's big. Just one more thing, man. My wife's nephew can't get enough of this thing called podcasting. Yes, that's right. That's right. He wrote seven episodes of Columbo. The first of which is like what's considered the series pilot, right? It's Murder by the Book, starring Jack Cassidy and directed by 25-year-old Steven Spielberg. How about that shit, man? So Stephen Bochco is going into the Fanachek Hall of Fame. Let's run down. You're going to indulge me now. I'm going to pull up Stephen Bochco on my phone. I'm going to run down the seven Columbo episodes my man wrote. And a lot of them are like legendary ones. Admittedly, some of the later ones I don't recall as well. But I know most of these pretty well. Let me pull it up here. Give me 1 second. Okay, so starting in season one, like I said, he did Murder by the Book. 1971, let's read the synopsis. When one member of a mystery writing team wants to break from his less talented partner, he becomes the victim in a real-life murder mystery. Of course, that starred Jack Cassidy as the killer. Jack Cassidy's David Cassidy's dad. Jack Cassidy famously burned in a horrific apartment fire because he was drunk and fell asleep in his lounge chair with a cigarette. And I have been in next door to that building because I had a buddy who lived in the building next door. That was a great episode. Is anyone else famous in this episode? No one that I can see. But that is Murder by the Book. Now, also in 1971, Stephen Bochco wrote Lady in Waiting. Let's read this synopsis. Oh, this is making me so excited. Okay. A mousy heiress murders her brother, pretending she thought he was a burglar. Lieutenant Columbo unravels her alibi. And this one's got a really cool poster, which, by the way, that's what I need, I think, is a Columbo poster. Holy shit, maybe I need this one. It's so cool. Anyway, Susan Clark was in this. She was the mom in Webster. Leslie Nielsen. That's right. Leslie Nielsen was in this before he really went into comedy. Richard Bull was in this. He's from Little House on the Prairie. Great episode. Really. What I loved about these shows too was it was always like rich people because it was LA. And so like it was always like these cool locations, big mansions, wealthy people, cool cars. If you like the 70s, man, Columbo is the best. It's like a time machine or a time capsule rather. All right. Also in season one, 1972's Blueprint for Murder. Oh, I love these titles. Oh, I remember this one, a construction worker one. Okay. Elliot Markham, a brilliant architect and con man, murders a Texas millionaire and hides his body in order to keep his visionary construction project financed. This was a good one too. It took place on this like big, like they're building a high rise. It's pretty wild. No one real famous in it, so I will keep moving on. All right, so now we're going to season two. 1972, Étude in Black. Étude, it's French, I'm not sure. Étude in Black. A ruthless conductor murders the gifted pianist with whom he is having an affair. Lieutenant Columbo is on the case. I love it. John Cassavetes was in this, as was Blythe Danner. That's Gwyneth Paltrow's mama, in case you didn't know. So that is season two. No, he did one more. He did Double Shock in season two, 1973. Double Shock. smarmy TV chef and his identical twin brother, a rigidly proper banker, are suspects in the electrocution of their rich uncle. And I remember this because the twins were played by Martin Landau. That was pretty cool. Great episode. Again, it's always rich people. It's awesome. Season 3, 1974, he writes Mind Over Mayhem. Ooh, I like the title. Mind Over Mayhem. The director of a government institute that employs various scientific geniuses commits a clever murder. But another kind of genius is on the case. Lieutenant Columbo. You can't freaking trick Columbo. What are you, on drugs? Then he does like this later one, season 9, 1990s, Uneasy Lies the Crown. And admittedly, I don't remember this one, so I got to go back and watch it. Okay. The handsome and charming junior partner in a dental group run by his father-in-law is a bad husband and a bad gambler with lots of debt. Facing divorce, ostracism, and worse, he devises a cunning plan. I bet he killed somebody, and I bet Columbo caught his ass. That's what you get when you commit murder on Columbo. So that is the 7 episodes that Stephen Bochco wrote of Columbo, and that was fun. That may be the most fun I've ever had on this podcast. Thank you for indulging me. But back to Stephen Bochco. So he would now create and write a few new shows that didn't quite work. So, you know, he's up and running, but they all can't be winners. So let's take a look. I'm going to pull it up here. So the first one he does is a show called Griff. It ran from 1973 to 1974. It lasted, let's see here, 12 episodes. Wade Griffin quits the police force after 3 decades to become a private eye. Boy, TV loves private eyes. Starred Lauren Green and Ben Murphy. Vic Tayback was in this. All right, Vic Tayback was Mel from Mel's Diner. I love that guy. He was also in a Columbo episode, actually. He played the hell did he play? He played like an artsy painter in Columbo. This show also featured, Bill Windham, who I did a whole episode on. Sal Mineo. Speaking of Rebel at a Cause, shit, Sal Mineo was in that. Scatman Crothers was in this. Ricardo Montalban was in this. He came up a lot in my last episode. Norman Fell was in this. He was Mr. Roper. This is fun. This is like a who's who of people here. I think that might be it. That is it. So that was, Susan Howard. She was in it too. Okay. So really fun cast. I dig that. That was Griff. So it did not last long. Then he would do The Invisible Man, another one that didn't last long. Ran from 1975 to 1976. Lasted 13 episodes. I really feel like we're trying to get Invisible Man stuff to work. Like, it's just, no one cares. I feel like there's been a million versions of The Invisible Man. The Weekly Adventures of Dr. Daniel Weston, an invisible scientist working as an agent for a private think tank. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of The Invisible Man stuff, although I will say, the Elizabeth Moss, what was it? Like Netflix or Hulu or something, Amazon maybe? But she did a movie a couple years ago that was actually pretty cool under the whole Invisible Man thing. Anyway, that show kind of came and went, had a weird cast. Then he did Del Vecchio, 1976 to 1977. I can't find it here. Let me pull it up. Search. Del Vecchio, again, 76 to 77. It lasted 22 episodes. The investigations of LAPD detective Dominic Del Vecchio, that's a cool name, who is also studying to become a lawyer. Ooh, I like it. It starred Judd Hirsch as Sergeant Dominic Del Vecchio. I'm kind of glad this show didn't last because Judd Hirsch would go on to do after this, Taxi. And that show was awesome. So, by the way, Del Vecchio is also Pauly D's last name from Jersey Shore. DJ Pauly D, his name's Pauly Del Vecchio. Which no one needed to know. I'm embarrassed that I know it. His time with Universal Studios now is coming to an end, right? So he created Richie Brockelman, Private Eye, which was like a bust. It lasted 5 episodes. He also wrote an episode of The White Shadow and 3 episodes of McMillan and Wife. So at this point, he leaves Universal. It's 1978. He leaves Universal and he teams up with MTM Enterprises. I hope you remember what I told you before, because MTM stands for Mary Tyler Moore, right? So Mary Tyler Moore started MTM Enterprises, MTM Productions, with her then husband, Grant Tinker. He was a big deal. He's a big swinging dick in Hollywood. They did shows like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, obviously, Rhoda, Bob Newhart Show, Phyllis, another spinoff of Mary Tyler Moore, WKRP in Cincinnati. But Bochco's time with them would be short-lived. His first project for Mary Tyler Moore would be creating the TV show Paris, starring James Earl Jones. It was kind of a big breakthrough for James Earl Jones, but not a breakthrough for television because it didn't do great. Let's take a look here. 79 to 80, 13 episodes. Woody Paris, police captain and loving husband, leads his team of detectives through the black and white and gray that constitutes the world of law and order. Ooh. Again, James Earl Jones. Who else was in this? Anyone else I recognize? Nope. Oh, Robert Englund. That's interesting. He was Freddy Krueger. So that is Paris. and it was not very good. But that's okay, because then 1981 came. And also with it came 6 years of Hill Street Blues. Stephen Boschko, boom, first massive major hit. 1981 to 1987. This show was amazing. Let's take a look here. Lasted 144 episodes. The lives and work of the staff of an inner city police precinct. It had 98 Emmy nominations during its run. It won 26 of them. The damn theme song. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun. Ooh, yeah. Well, anyway, that got weird. That won a Grammy. Like, that's how popular this damn show was. Right? The theme song won a Grammy. Who was the cast? The cast had a million people in it. I'm trying to think of the big ones here. Oh, Betty Thomas. So Betty Thomas is from Second City. She became a director. She is actually good friends with Howard Stern. She directed his movie Private Parts. Ed Marnar. I forgot he was in this. Dennis Franz, George Weiner. I mean, this is just Robert Prosky. He was also in Fame. Just an amazing cast. Ken Olin, who were going to do 30-something. Jeffrey Tambor. This show was the best. It was like considered one of the first kind of like realistic police shows that also that show their lives outside of the police force. It wasn't all action. It was the first show, this is kind of interesting, to cost $1 million per episode, which I have to think may have led to his downfall there at Mary Tyler Moore. And I'll tell you why. Because he left Mary Tyler Moore during the run of the show, and there's like two reasons given. One is his inability to keep the show on budget. So I think that pissed him off. But also during this time, he created a show called Bay City Blues. It was supposed to be a big hit. I think a lot of money went behind it. It was about a minor league baseball team, I guess, called the Bay City Blues. I could look it up, but my phone's like all the way over there. It was a failed TV show, so that pissed off MTM. But anyway, his time with Mary Tyler Moore was over. So he left. He went to 20th Century Fox. And I guess as a fuck you, he created L.A. Law. Boom. It's like this guy just wham. He comes right back after Hill Street Blues. L.A. Law. This show was a beast. 1986 to 1994. 171 episodes. The lives and work of the staff of a major Los Angeles law firm. So this show was like a who's who, man. Corbin Burnson, Jimmy Smits, Blair Underwood, Susan Day. Susan Day, she was in the Partridge Family, right? She was, hell, I don't know. I never watched the Partridge Family, but she was a hot chick. She was like the Marsha Brady of the Partridge Family. Also, Harry Hamlin was in this, man. Harry Hamlin from Clash of the Titans. Now he's on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. He's married to Lisa Rinna, the chick with the big old lips there. L.A. Law was a big, big deal. Let's take a look here. What did I want to say about it? Won 15 Emmys. What I remember about it is this. So when I was a kid, it was on a lot, but I was a little too young to kind of get into it. So it was usually like whatever shows I was watching, I guess, tended to be a lead in for L.A. Law because I feel like I saw the beginning of it a lot. But there was one famous episode, and I don't know if it was like a series of episodes or what, that clearly stand out to me. And it featured a character with Tourette syndrome. So there was this, and you can probably look it up. I'm sure it's popular. But this guy was, you know, in the courtroom, I guess being, I don't know if he was a witness or what, but, or maybe he's a lawyer, but I think he was a witness. But he got up on the stand with Tourette's and he started yelling and cursing at people. And as, you know, a 9-year-old, that shit was pretty funny to me. I gotta admit. But that's my biggest memory of L.A. Law, besides like the cool opening. But again, I was a little too young to appreciate it. But back to Stephen Boschko, because it's official. At this point, my man is a legend. He's a very wealthy man, but he's not done. 1987, he creates Hooperman. Now, Hooperman's special to me. I like this show because it brought back John Ritter. So I think this was like the first big thing John Ritter did after Three's Company, at least the first big thing I remember him in, because I know he tried a movie career, didn't quite work. Freewheeling San Francisco cop Harry Hooperman inherits a rundown apartment building and the building owner's mean, hateful, and just plain annoying dog, Bijou. Not having the time to maintain the building and tend to his police work, Hooperman hires feisty, aspiring writer Susan Smith as his superintendent/maintenance person. He and Smith soon begin a relationship, like you do, and the series chronicles the ups and downs of the relationship along with Hooperman's efforts as a policeman. So I really liked it. Like I said, it lasted 42 episodes. It was a minor hit, 87 to 89. I just as a kid thought it was so cool to see Jack Dripper back, John Ritter. Who else was in this? No one that I really recognize. Anyway, and I remember this show too was one of the first times I heard the word bitch on TV. So I'm sure it had been done before, but it's one of the first times I heard it on TV. Fun show. But Hooperman was also significant because it was the first show created by Stephen Boschko Productions. So let's talk about that. I touched on it briefly in the opening. So basically, After the success of L.A. Law, ABC and CBS get into a big bidding war over Stephen Bochco. ABC had just ended their relationship there in Spelling, so they're looking for a new genius to start creating shows for them. So there was a big bidding war, and they won, and they got it. They signed a deal with Stephen Bochco to start his own company, Bochco Productions, and create and produce 10 new TV shows, and Hooperman was the first. Up next after Hooperman was da-na-na-na. I know no one probably recognized that. It was Doogie Howser, MD, man. That was a great show. 1989 to 1993, 97 episodes. Doogie Howser, of course, was a young kid. He had childhood cancer. He was a genius. He had cancer. And as a cancer survivor, he decided he wanted to devote his life to helping others. So he became a teenage doctor because he was a genius. Of course, it was Neil Patrick Harris. Max Casella was his friend, Vinny Delpino. He's had a big run. You know, he went on to do – what the hell else did he do? I mean, I know him from the Sopranos. He was Benny Fazio on the Sopranos. He's done a ton of stuff, though. Look him up. Max Casella. The guy's not stopped working. Every episode of Doogie Howser, I remember, ended with him at the computer writing his computer diary. So, like, it was, you know, it was always some lesson learned, and it always ended with some clever line. But that was how every Doogie Howser episode ended. I also remember I had a seventh grade teacher who I fucking hated. I should say her name so you guys could hunt her down for me. But she was awful. But I remember and she did not like me, which is maybe why I thought she was awful. But I remember she was just a big fan of this show. She was always encouraging kids should watch Doogie Howser. It's a wholesome show. Da 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 da. And I was like, fuck you. But I did like the show. Anyway, but they can't all be winners, right? Because after Doogie Howser, he does the historically bad. Like, this is holy shit. And history has been kind to him because I don't think people remember it. But it was so bad at the time. 1990s cop rock. Cop Rock. It was a musical cop show. The musical adventures of a police force. So it lasted just 11 episodes in 1990. It was fucking horrible. So if I recall, it premiered big. Like, I want to say it premiered, geez Louise, like I think like during the soup, like after the Super Bowl. It was one of those shows. So like it had this big world stage and it was an epic fail. Bill O'Reilly listed it as the fifth worst show of all time. But, you know, you got to take that with a grain of salt because Bill O'Reilly's kind of a dumb shit. I applaud the ambition. I think it's kind of neat. They basically took a procedural cop show and implementing also the trial portion of it, kind of like Law and Order, but set to music and dancing. Not just music, but there's dancing. I don't know. But I made it out to read the review. Here's a review. The name of the review is very bizarre. All right. Cop Rock was a typical police drama, except for the fact that it was also a musical. Everybody sang. The cops, the criminals, even the judge and jury in the courtroom during trials. With its many lavish song and dance routines and catchy tunes, Cop Rock was almost like a Broadway musical adaptation of Hill Street Blues. Cop Rock was heavily promoted by ABC in the weeks before its premiere in the fall of 1990. Apparently, ABC thought they had a huge hit on their hands, even though it was the first ever cop show / musical on TV. Not surprisingly, the show was savaged by critics and ignored by audiences. Despite the large amounts of publicity and money, because like I said, I'm pretty sure it came out after the Super Bowl. Despite the large amounts of publicity and money invested in the series, which was one of the most expensive TV shows ever made up to that point at a cost of nearly $2 million an episode, it was canceled after only 3 months. Yes, this was epically bad. Like I said, history's been kind because I don't think a lot of people remember it. But boy, that's a good thing. Anyway, so during this time, though, he's pumping out other shows. Capital Critters was a cartoon. He did a show called Civil Wars with Marielle Hemingway. I like Marielle Hemingway. I always thought she was super pretty. She was a star of Star 80. She played Dorothy Stratton. And he was in a lull, right? I mean, Stephen Bochco at this point, he's in a slump. Maybe he was done. Maybe he's all dried up. I don't know. Time to retire. But then came inspiration in the form of David Caruso's naked ass. NYPD Blue, y'all. NYPD Blue. Like, this guy's not done. Another massive hit. 1993 to 2005, 261 episodes. What? Detectives from NYPD's 15th precinct investigate homicides within their precinct. My lord. I don't even know where to start with this damn show. Cha-ching! We start with that. So basically, when the show started, I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I mean, I was in high school, so I remember this really, really well. What the heavy promotion of it before it even came out was going to be that this was going to be the first show to really push the boundaries of cursing and nudity on network TV. They had me at nudity. So I was like, whoa. And they didn't, you know, I mean, compared to today, it was very tame. But I remember seeing some naked butts. I was like, look at that. It was a girl's butt. And look at that. It's Caruso's butt. You know, I wasn't as excited about the, I shouldn't have sounded so excited. I wasn't that excited about Caruso's butt. But it was a big hit. It starred Amy Brenneman, David Caruso, Dennis Franz, Nicholas Turturro, among others. Then, of course, Caruso famously leaves. So David Caruso, and this guy's had 9 lives. I don't know how he's had this much success, but he had a big head right off the bat. He leaves after season 1. He's replaced by Jimmy Smits. Jimmy Smits had a great run on the show. He eventually was replaced by Rick Schroeder. And then eventually Mark Paul Gosselaar stepped into the role. And I think the show ended with Mark Paul Gosselaar. It's just a weird thing, but just a great show. Fantastic show. Dennis Franz was probably the big breakaway star, I think. He played Sipowicz, had a great career. And interestingly, just yesterday, as I record this, his TV son, who was on the show for 7 seasons, passed away. He was 27 years old. I don't remember his name. I apologize. I think it was drugs because he was living in a homeless center when he died. Although he wasn't homeless, so they think maybe he was high and ended up there, but he was only 27 years old. He played Dennis Franz's son on the show, Sipowicz's son, and he passed away, so tip of 40 for him. Anyway, that would be, though, Stephen Bochco's final big hit. That was it. So during the NYPD Blue run, he would also create I'll kind of run through them pretty quickly. Public Morals lasted 13 episodes. Murder One, 41 episodes. Total Security, 12 episodes. Brooklyn South, 22 episodes. City of Angels, 24 episodes. Philly, 22 episodes. Blind Justice, 13 episodes. Over There, 13 episodes. In 2005, he took charge of an existing show, Commander in Chief, which we've talked about a lot on the show. So Commander in Chief was already around. It was struggling a bit. Lasted 2005 to 2006. Is that right? Yep. Lasted 19 episodes. So the show had already been created. I guess the pilot had been shot, but they wanted the genius of Stephen Bochco. He stepped in to kind of help it. Mackenzie Allen becomes the first woman American president after she ascends to the job following the death of President Teddy Bridges. Bridges, remember that for a second because that comes back. So the cast, of course, famously, Gina Davis, Donald Sutherland, great cast. Who else was in this? Those are the only two that I remember. Natasha Henstridge, Mark Paul Gosselaar. That fucker keeps coming back, doesn't he? He's like another one with 9 lives. Okay, but that's Commander in Chief, last 19 episodes. Gina Davis got an Emmy nom for this, and she won a Golden Globe. So here's why I said remember Bridges. It was originally intended to star Joan Allen and be a sequel to the movie The Contender with Jeff Bridges. So, but Joan Allen didn't want to do it, so they changed some of the names, some of the story. And I know the show, of course, I've told the story. I ended up in that Oval Office by a series of weird things. I was on the studio lot screening a movie I had been in, a shitty movie I'd been in, by the way. And afterwards, we just had a pass. Me and my buddy were walking around, and we just found ourselves in the Oval Office there. And I've said this before, one of my big regrets in life is I didn't steal something from that set. How do I not have a little framed picture of Gina Davis or a pen from the White House? I don't know, something. But I didn't. Anyway, Stephen Bochco took over the show, and it was not a positive experience. He had differences with ABC, and he quit, which proved fatal for the show because it was canceled soon after, right? So at this point, he really wanted to stop working for network television. He found it stifling. He's kind of quoted as saying, like, the network executives keep staying the same age, but he keeps getting older, and he's no longer a contemporary of theirs, so it's harder and harder to relate to them. He would create 2 more short-lived shows. He created Raising the Bar, a 2008 show, a legal drama with Mark Paul Gosselaar. That guy keeps coming back. And Murder in the First, 2014 show with Taye Diggs. Mr. Bochco would pass away a few years later from leukemia in 2018. Gone but not forgotten, because something kind of neat happened in 2021, 3 years later, a TV series called Doogie Kamealoha MD. Yep, a new show inspired by Doogie Howser MD. Lasted 20 episodes. Let me pull up the synopsis, right? Doogie Kamealoha MD. Lahela Doogie Kamealoha is teenage wonderkind juggling her high school life with an early medical career. Produced by Disney Plus. Obviously, I love it. It was inspired by Stephen Bochco's Doogie Howser MD. Got solid reviews and was a fitting tribute, I think, to a guy who gave us thousands of hours of entertainment. So rest in peace, Stephen Bochco, and thank you. Thank you for everything you did. And you know what? Thank you, listeners. I appreciate you indulging me as I ramble on about stuff that I'm excited about. So If you like the show, do me a favor, leave a positive review. That is always helpful. Please email me, ask me questions. I'd love to read them on the air. You can find me at fanacekpodcast@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter, but I don't use it a whole hell of a lot, @fanacekpodcast. And you can find me on Facebook, Real Fanacek, which I do use a lot because I'm on there writing to Eddie Deason and stuff. What's up? Thank you so much for listening. And of course, as always, stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanacek.